We've been on a guided tour of the five aggregates this week. We've looked at each of them, and I've been inspired to hear in some of the practice discussions how you're starting to notice them in your own experience. So the good news is that we're going to go through them all again, but in a different way. So you'll get another pass at this teaching. But that starts tomorrow. So here we are in this pregnant pause. And the image that came to mind for me was of a fish or a dolphin leaping up vertically out of the water and then turning in the air before plunging back in. So today we're suspended in the culmination of the five aggregates, and we'll take some time to synthesize the teachings so far and also to reorient in preparation for the next go around. So, when I was in elementary school, I would walk to and from school. And on the route that I took home, I would come around a corner, and there was a little gray tree stump there in the yard. And it's pretty small, and it had one of those, where the roots come out of the bottom and then go down into the ground. It had kind of one long straggling root. And when I saw it, I would think for a moment that it was a cat, but it didn't move as I went by. So then I would see that it was a tree stump. And at that point, of course, I had never heard of Buddhist practice or mindfulness, certainly not the five aggregates. But I did notice that my mind would say cat every time it came around the corner, even though I had already gone through the process of thinking cat and then realizing stump. So I thought that was curious. And sometimes I would even remember as I approached the corner that when I would come around it, there would be this stump. And it wasn't a cat, but my mind would still go there. So, of course, I didn't have, any language for this at the time, but this is about perception, about the labeling or recognition of an experience. And it's conditioned. And it doesn't immediately change when we get new information. Sometimes it does, like when Gil talked about the dividing line down the middle of the Zendo vanishing when people walked across it. But sometimes it doesn't go away quite that fast. So maybe one thing to note here is that these aggregates really do point to how the mind functions. I was in elementary school. I was very innocent. And yet there was this process happening in my mind, and I noticed it. So it doesn't have to be so complex to see these functions of the mind. Actually, one of the easiest ways to see perception is when it fails. That's a common time when we see it. So to give a kind of a review, the first aggregate is what we've been calling appearances, rupa in Pali. And this emphasizes the experiential nature of it. We know the world through our sense doors, through contact. Things appear to our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body sense, and also the mind door. And then there is Vedana, feeling tone, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality of experience. And it starts to bring in our response to the appearances, because the pleasant or the unpleasant is not inherent to the object. So we have the clear participation of our mind. And then the third aggregate is perception, sanya in Pali. And this is the recognition of what is experienced. So it depends on memory. One of the conditions for it is that we have experienced something like that before, and we can match up, if you will, our present experience with some kind of memory. So this means that it actually has something of a limiting function, because it takes the fullness of experience and it matches it up with a concept that resembles it. And that's just how it works. But it's essential to do that in order to navigate the world. We can't learn afresh what every single thing is, every single appearance. And so we use this shortcut, and that can, you know, that's helpful and also can have consequences. And then the fourth aggregate are the mental formations, the sankhara. And Gill described this as generative thinking. And this can be true. We have our wandering thoughts and our self-perpetuating emotions. But sankhara also includes wholesome qualities like patience, compassion, generosity, kindness. Those are all mental formations. So is mindfulness a mental formation? So this is a very broad realm. And it also has the special function of constructing all of the aggregates, including itself. So sankhara, to make together, it puts things together, as well as being the product of that putting together. It's a self-consistent process. And then there's consciousness, the knowing function of the mind. And it can be subtle, as Andrea talked about it yesterday, but there are also times when it's the most obvious thing occurring in the mind. When the other aggregates have gotten quiet, everything else has gotten quiet, the knowing can be quite prominent at times. So we can select each of these aggregates out of experience, but they are all present in each moment of experience. So we can deliberately look for them, going through the scales, as we've been calling it. Or we could also simply notice which aggregate is naturally being attended to by the mind. You know, there is a natural process of moving along with experience, and we'll see that the mind changes around among which aggregate it's connected with or knowing. And that's also a sankhara, that it's conditioned what we will notice based on our past. So we could say about these aggregates that they're distinct but not separable. And this is like the way water and wetness. Water and wetness are not separable. So there's the water and there's the wetness, and they're definitely connected, but they're not the same thing. The water and the wetness are not identical. So if you now imagine a similar situation with five components instead of two, that gives a sense. So what do we notice when we start tuning in to the aggregates? We've been emphasizing this week that they are processes. they're not really things, are they? In a sense, they're verbs instead of nouns. In fact, we've been pointing to a teaching where the Buddha defines the aggregates as verbs. And he says in this sutta, why do you call it feeling? It feels, therefore, it is called feeling. Similarly, it perceives, therefore, it's called perception, or it appears, therefore, it's appearances. So, from this, we see, processes are things that are ongoing, that are changing, that are by nature moving. So we see the impermanent and changing nature of the aggregates. And we also see that they are conditioned. This is a word that's used a lot. What does it really mean? Means that there are things that don't arise out of nothing, and they also they have components to them, and when those conditions are there, then we have the product of that, and if the conditions fall away, then what we were observing will end. So it's dependent on other things that are present. The process of seeing is dependent, is conditioned by there being a sight object, a functioning eye, and light, and attention or consciousness on the process. Andrea described this yesterday. So there's the experiences that we have come about because there are components in place that support them, and they shift and change as those components shift and change. We'll see that this is a very important quality of the aggregates to understand their impermanent and conditioned nature, has many implications for how we understand experience and also for suffering and reaching the end of it. Because the issue with the aggregates is that they are the main domains in which we cling. According to the Buddha, when we cling to appearance, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, and/or consciousness. So to one of the aggregates or some combination, he says. And when there is clinging, there is suffering. There is dukkha. That's the second noble truth, is that they arise together. So the aggregates really lie at the heart of what the Buddha was teaching, a way to the end of suffering. So that's going to involve not clinging to the aggregates. The five aggregates are actually called the five clinging aggregates, or sometimes the five aggregates subject to clinging. They're often referred to with that qualifier. But it's interesting that it emphasizes a little bit, since there is that qualifier on there, the aggregates of clinging, that maybe we don't have to cling to them. The Buddha, while he was alive, still experienced all of the five aggregates. He had sense experience, his mind perceived, and he experienced feeling tone, all of that. But for him, they were not clinging aggregates. They were not aggregates of clinging. So there is a way to make this shift through our practice. So the good news is that we only cling to the aggregates in two ways. That's pretty good. Only two ways that we cling to it. We possess them as mine, or we identify with them, making them me or who I am, some kind of self. Now, of course, within those two main ways, there are our myriad particularities that we've been observing in our minds this week, but it really just comes down to the self and what belongs to the self. So, for example, we can easily think about my pain. We can identify, you know, if pain is a strong sensory experience that we're having, we may feel like we become that experience. It defines our whole world, that pain. Or equally, we may experience my emotions or my thoughts or my views. We can even identify with consciousness. If we have a sense that our experience is happening to someone, then we have identified with the experiencer. We are the experiencer of what is happening. So this process of the self and what belongs to it, it's really good to start seeing this process of selfing. I'm going to make it into a verb. That's what we're talking about with these aggregates. So selfing is a process. It's a verb. And there are so many constructions happening all the time, these sankharas. But the Buddha picked this one out as worthy of special notice. And that's, of course, because there's so much dukkha around selfing. So I want to say right up front that it's not a terrible, horrible occurrence to create a self or an idea of mine. If we see that happening, then that's very good. Then what we have is mindfulness of selfing, mindfulness of this process happening, which is like mindfulness of the breath or mindfulness of being tired. We can have mindfulness of selfing, the creation of a self. So one time, some years ago, I was on retreat here at IRC, and I was doing walking meditation out in the parking lot. I went out to the front lot, and I was walking back and forth, nice and peacefully, in front of a row of cars, and just minding my business, doing my practice. And then this memory arose. I think it was a 2-week retreat, and it had been some time since I had arrived. And this memory arose. Wait a minute, didn't I park somewhere near here? And I looked, and I had been walking back and forth right in front of a row of cars that included my car. And suddenly my car looked different than the other cars. Oh, that's my car. Wait a minute. And suddenly it was there, sort of blossomed up out of the row of cars as the special car that was mine. And so I just watched my mind, you know, this process of the self arising, what belongs to a self. And then, of course, there were, you know, other things that went with that, like, gee, have my tires gone down while I've been not driving the car for a while? And, you know, other thoughts came in. So it's really interesting when we can catch the mind, you know, where was I before that? You know, I guess I wasn't needed until then, but and conditioned by this memory. So the self is born, it's born as a perception, as a concept. Most of the time, that is so quick that we don't see that perception happening. The Buddha said that one of the main distortions of perception is that we think what is not self is actually self. And then once that concept is in place, it's easy to spin off into this generative thinking, into sankhara, with, you know, myself at the center of it. So we create whole worlds, and then we live in them. We live in these stories that we weave around myself. But have we ever really checked into this self? Have we looked at it a little bit more carefully? So here on this retreat, we have a chance to see the arising and passing away of identification, like the way I saw my car arise when it wasn't there before. Really interesting, because it's not there all the time. It's extra, actually. Yeah, just thinking about this notion of the worlds that arise. I remember also a time in meditation when I was fairly calm at that time. Some samadhi had come, and I was watching. It wasn't really deep samadhi. There were these thoughts coming and going, but I was just watching them as kind of occurrences, like, you know, a mother might watch her children on the playground. You know, oh, look at that, playing there. And sometimes in my inner eye, it looked kind of like a little bubble would start to arise in the mind. And it was almost like one of those snow globes, you know, where you can, it's a little bubble with liquid in it in a scene inside. And I could see this world starting to arise. And I could see that if I were to enter into that, it would be as if I had, you know, stepped into a world, and it would support, you know, it would support a whole sense of self there. And just having that moment where I could see this little bubble before, you know, before it enveloped my awareness was so important, you know, so useful. And sometimes I just went in anyway, you know, as we do that. And then later I would say, oh, I saw that moment of the bubble and went right in. But sometimes, you know, sometimes it wouldn't happen that way. So, you know, it helps to have some lightness as we start to look at the self and in how it works. We've been using this image of a magician in various ways. So we could also consider that selfing is kind of a trick. And, you know, it's something that gets conjured up by the mind. And then when that happens, we're not so enchanted by it. Now, there's this word in Buddhism that people often feel a little unsure about, that we're supposed to get disenchanted with experience or with, yeah. And they think, I don't want to be disenchanted. That doesn't sound very positive. But when we think about being enchanted, it's like having a magic spell cast over us. We're not seeing accurately. Our mind is not so free. So it's really good to be disenchanted, actually, in this practice. And it's a slow process of seeing things again and again and seeing how they work, seeing the trick. I wish it were as simple as that as soon as we see the trick, it's immediately, sometimes it's like that, but often we have to see a lot of times. Sometimes they say you have to see a certain pattern 10,000 times. So it's really good to practice with this kind of seeing. Andrea said yesterday that when we see the impermanent and conditioned nature of the aggregates, identification is naturally reduced. And it has to be, because you know, when we see that they're just changing all the time and they're dependent on these conditions that are also changing, it starts to look quite unstable. Not exactly the place where we could land, as Andrea was saying, that's it. That's where I can stand finally. Just doesn't, the evidence is too strong that that's not how it works. We have to slowly take in, gather data again and again, seeing that. So the Buddha encouraged investigation of this selfing process, and particularly our ideas of a fixed self, of some entity that is perpetual. And he did this in many different ways, but I'll focus on one for now, which is the issue of control. There's a sutta where the Buddha asks us to consider each aggregate and ask whether we have control in that area. But if something is part of ourself, we should have some agency somehow. And as we do this, we tend to find that there isn't as much as we thought, not as much control as we thought. So, for example, in the realm of the physical senses, it's not really possible to control how our body is, not so much. We put a lot of energy and effort into the small number of areas that we can. You know, hairdo, painted nails, what clothing we wear, these kinds of things. But what about if we took this seriously as a reflection? Could you be 2 inches taller than you are? No? How about 10 years younger? No, okay. So it's not really possible to make some kind of declaration, you know, may it be like this or may it not be like this. There are plenty of things that happen that we would like to say, no, I didn't want it that way. It's not really the case. Of course, maybe we wouldn't even want to necessarily. There are some areas. I was thinking about control and I thought, would I really want complete control of this? I found this lovely quote from Lewis Thomas, who is a 20th century biologist. And he said this about the liver. If I were informed tomorrow that I was in direct communication with my liver and could take over now, I would become deeply depressed. Nothing would save me and my liver if I were in charge, for I am, to face the facts squarely, considerably less intelligent than my liver. I would not be able to think of the first thing to do. So it helps to know that the liver is responsible for more than 500 chemical processes in the body. I mean, this is the ultimate management nightmare to be put in charge of all of that. So we can see that there's a lot in the sensory world that is just happening. When we really reflect on that aspect of our life, the most basic, in a sense, sensory world, a lot of it is just happening. And we don't know the details. What is the body really? Do we really know? And then in the case of Feeling tone. We can't dictate, may the next experience be pleasant. If we could do that, they'd all be pleasant. But it doesn't work that way either. Even the Buddha had back pain, and he would sometimes arrive at a town after walking all day, and he would turn to one of the monks and say, "You give the Dharma talk to these good people in this town. I'm going to rest my back." So even for Buddhas, there's still unpleasant feeling tone. And then in the case of, perception and mental formations, consciousness, we can't control those aspects of the mind so much either. Not totally. I saw this as a child where my mind kept labeling that stump as cat, even though I knew better after the first time. Even if we've seen through the formation of a self, the mind still produces that pattern for a while. I remember on one retreat a while ago, I was a little bit in a controlling mindset. I think I wanted something to happen, or I wanted my practice to look a certain way. And I must have tried for a long time different things and began to feel a little bit like that whack-a-mole game where you aim for one thing and it pops up somewhere else. And but I think that maybe the Dharma was setting me up with all of that attempt at control, to have an insight at some point in the retreat where the insight appeared as kind of a phrase and said, "Relax, it runs by itself." And in the context of those conditions, that was a big relief. It allowed the control mindset to fall away. So it can be disconcerting or disorienting to realize that things are just happening without me in charge. That can come during practice, and that's okay. Okay. It can also be relieving. That's another option. And of course, whatever response we have is just one more thing to know. This is the experience of not self, and this is how my mind is in relationship to that. Over time, we tend to increase our capacity for being with these kind of more universal qualities of experience, its impermanence, its conditioned nature, its impersonality, its unsatisfactoriness. There are ways in which we have to tune our system to tolerate these truths. There's part of us that doesn't like that very much, doesn't want that to be the way it is. But fortunately, through mindfulness, we gather more and more data, and it becomes more and more clear. We just get more used to it and, in fact, find some ease, some peace with this way of how things are. So, as we start to see in terms of the ongoing construction of experience, just conditions unfolding, there can come a point where we want this constructing process to stop. There's actually a particular kind of stress associated with constructing. It's called sankhara dukkha. It's tiring. You know, it's tiring to continually fabricate. And it's good to have this kind of weariness, but it turns out that we can't make it stop. Remember, this is an area where we don't have control. We can't say, may the mental formations be thus, may the mental formations not be thus. We can't say that. So when we're wanting mental formations to end, that wanting is a mental formation. So the Buddha gives us an alternative. There's a sutta where he is naming the best of various things. And he says that the best of all constructions, that is the best of all sankhara, is the Eightfold Path. The path is a special kind of construction that leads to the end of dukkha. The path is something that is made, but that process includes the activity of deconstructing, of unmaking. The monk Tanisiro Bhikkhu says, "The closer you come to freedom, the more you find that things fall away. First, the nouns of natures and identities fall away as you focus on the verbs. And then the verbs fall away too. When the Buddha was asked who or what he was, he didn't answer with a who or a what. He said simply, awakened, a past participle, a verb that has done its work. There's no noun, no pronoun, just a past participle released. That's all, but it's enough." So if we had to name the activity that is done on the path, maybe we could say it is non-clinging. The aggregates are the domains of clinging, and the path is not to cling. And there are many, many ways not to cling. One of the main ones, one of the most effective ones, which we're practicing here, is seeing, mindfulness. When we're mindful of anything, really, we're less caught, and we're reducing our clinging in that moment. The activities of greed, hatred, and delusion, which are related to clinging, are what is this generative, productive aspect of experience. And the qualities of non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion are not generative in the way that Gil was talking about. So they reduce the clinging, calm things down. It's quite a common phrase in the suttas to say that a person has been liberated through non-clinging. And the phrase could just as easily be translated as liberated by means of non-clinging. So the non-clinging is how we do it, the path. And then it doesn't even matter so much which aggregate you're seeing. You know, we don't need so much to analyze that and figure out exactly which one. In the words of Joseph Goldstein, it does not matter to what you do not cling. So the dolphin leaps up out of the water. We've leaped out of our usual lives, our usual roles, our usual self in the world. And we've begun to see in terms of the aggregates, just processes happening. Impermanent, impersonal, conditioned. It's a different view, a different orientation to our experience. And now we're poised to look again at these aggregates from this new perspective. A fish that has left the water has a different reference point. Of course, in another sense, nothing is really different. It's still experience happening and the knowing of that. Practice continues. And as these words pass away into silence, there can just be the release. So let's sit together for a moment.